Okay, so welcome everyone to the inaugural session of the Football Scholars Forum for 2017-2018. It's a great pleasure to welcome Gwendolyn Oxenham, author of Under the Lights and In the Dark, Untold Stories of Women's Soccer. Gwen has participated in FSF before. She is a filmmaker. Many of you know the movie Pelada, which is a wonderful documentary about chasing pickup soccer around the world. And I have to say, when Gwen was kind enough to participate in a Skype video call a while back with my daughter's soccer team, you know, they still talk about that, both the movie and the fact that the filmmaker, you know, was kind enough to join the conversation. And that came also, that was followed by a book linked to that project entitled Finding the Game, 3 years and 25 countries and the search for pickup soccer, published by St. Martin's Press. And she's written a lot for various publications like Sports Illustrated and The Atlantic and others. And she's a former Duke University soccer player and teaches literature, I believe. Yes, Gwen, is that correct?
Creative writing, composition.
Creative writing.
Yeah.
Yes, so also an academic as well as a journalist. And the way we usually do it at FSF is allow the author to speak for just a few minutes to kind of give some context and background about the book, and then we just get right into it with the Q&A. Okay, so why don't we pass the ball over to Gwen in California. Over to you.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for everybody joining today. So just to give you a sense of how the book came to be, basically, as you know from if you've read the intro, so I play professional soccer in Brazil. And just the moment where I'm hitchhiking on the side of the road, which was a daily occurrence, and just I whenever I was there with my thumb out, on my way to play for Santos, the most storied club in futebol history, it just blew my mind that this is what professional women's soccer looks like. And it just made me wonder about all the other stories that were out there. What no one has any sense of what it means to be a professional women's soccer player in so many countries around the world. So I wanted to go on a scavenger hunt, basically, to see what I could find. And, you know, having played in Brazil, I thought I had a sense of what was out there. But then when I dug in and, you know, started calling friends of friends of friends and other players, I was just continually astonished by the both the inequality and then the incredible, inspiring, you know, responses to that inequality. So that's some background on how the book came to be. I mean, for those of you who haven't read it, I guess I can give you just a little nutshell synopsis of some of the stories of, you know, Alinko is a Nigerian national team player who grew up in a home where there wasn't enough space to turn over at night. And through soccer, she's able to change the fate of her entire family. There's Nadia Nadim's story. You know, she's one of the stories that was a little bit more known. Her father was executed by the Taliban, and she fled Afghanistan and learned how to play in refugee camp in Denmark. And so I got the chance to talk to her for a really long time and do a more in-depth version of her story. There's Farrah Williams and her friendship with a homeless teenager, and how Farrah Williams totally changes this teenager's life based on their like common experience of homelessness. Let's see, the Russian madness of everything from the mafia to steroids to unbelievable, you know, I don't know. I see you can see my speechlessness when talking about the Russian chapter. And also the comeback moms, you know, in women, you when I was a kid, I remember watching, you know, Joy Fawcett on the sideline and reading Rick Riley's articles about the U.S. women's team and the diaper bags. And I thought motherhood and soccer went very much hand in hand. So I was really surprised then to hear four different stories of top professional women soccer players who were all cut or traded due to motherhood. There's the Play Away the Gay chapter about the semi-pro team in North Carolina, which was the highest league you could play in for a period of time, where you know, you have to sign something saying you are not gay, and this is in the year 2017. So it's kind of players' experiences on this evangelical soccer team as they deal with Christianity and sexuality and where those two things meet. So those are just some of the chapters, and just trying to get, you know, look around the world and see, uh-oh, I just got a note saying my internet connection is unstable. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So you, what can I tell you guys about?
Well, the first question is going to come from Alex. Alex, go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thank you, Gwen, so much for joining us. And thank you for the book. I really, really enjoyed it. The Ali Long chapter is well selected. The first one really engages you. And then when the Russia chapter opens with Danny getting slapped by the coach, I was like, wow, okay, it's going to be hard to put down. So I really enjoyed reading it. It was also, you know, some difficult parts to read. Some really, you know, I think the Play Away the Gay chapter was probably like the most gut-wrenching one to read. I mean, there's plenty of tragedy and heartache in the book, but just the way you captured a number of people in that chapter, their struggles with the love of the game, with who they are, with what they're going through, with the players they considered, you know, like their family. It was really, yeah, it was difficult to read. But my question is about Brazil. I think a number of us have probably seen the emails you circulated. May even be listening to Brenda Elsie's participation in the podcast of Burn It All Down and her interviews with Cece and Zappa. Kara Snyder sent the open letter around to the group as well. So I'm wondering if you have been tracking, I imagine you've been tracking what's been happening, if you've got any particular insights on what's developing with the CBFA, and what you kind of see this moment with the Argentine players going on strike and this open letter from Brazil and the start of women's teams participating in the Copa Libertadores as a requisite for men's teams by 2019. How do you think that's going to change the landscape for the CONMEBOL presence in the 2019 World Cup in France?
You know, so when I played in Brazil, we were never allowed to play in the men's stadium. No one knew a women's team existed. Marta had been on the international scene for, I don't know how many years by then, maybe only a couple, but I would ask everyone, like, do you know Marta? And no one knew. And then obviously with the 2016 Olympics, Brazil was for the maybe kind of first time paying attention to the women's game in a noticeable way. And, you know, with the announcement that Brazil, that for all of South America, that you must have a women's team to play in Copa Libertadores, I mean, that's a huge development. I have not been following the more recent happenings with what's going on in Brazil right now, and would love to be kind of filled in on that. But to me, the most disturbing thing that I encountered while looking into the current landscape of the Brazilian women's game was the part in Santos in 2009, I believe. They asked the woman to pose for a bikini calendar, and then several months later in January, they cut the entire women's team to keep Neymar, and that coupling to me of asking someone to walk down a catwalk and then cutting the whole team, that's a low moment in Brazilian professional women's soccer. I mean, Santos was the number one team for women in the country. And the fact that now we're at a point where many clubs will have pro teams is so incredibly hopeful, yet I can only imagine the numbers of nightmare scenarios that might grow out of that as teams attempt to implement that rule. But can you give me catch me up on what I may have missed in the last couple of months?
My understanding of it is fairly surface level from what I've been catching. Maybe Kara Snyder could say a few words about it. Not to put you on the spot, Kara.
Not to put you on the spot, Kara.
Is that okay?
I guess I would just say, like, a lot of it's in that. So the Brazilian women's national team had for the first time a woman coach, Emily Lima. And Emily Lima was fired 6 months into her gig without having played any, like, they fired her basically for no reason, saying that she wasn't performing well, the CBF, even though she hadn't had the opportunity to take the team to any, like, real competitions. It was all just, unofficial games. And then one of the players quit in protest, and then four of the players quit in protest. And then the letter that was circulated were from kind of the founders from the 96 team, like Ceci, Formiga, Juliana Cabral. They all wrote a letter to the CBF that was like, hey, this is embarrassing. We don't have any women in leadership positions. Many of us have occupied like international like posts abroad. Why isn't Brazil investing in its own players? Why is it happening other places? And so the CBF actually called the players to a meeting, and the meeting happened recently, like within the past week. And I'm not sure how the meeting went. Like, there's different takes on it. Some people are like, oh, they're just paying us lip service, but nothing's actually going to change. And other people feel more hopeful, like, hey, this might actually cause a radical restructuring of the CBF. So I think it's kind of in limbo, but there has been this mass mobilization of athletes, kind of having Emily Lima's firing be the last straw.
Wow. Thank you. Do you know if what's going on the professional landscape in Brazil at all?
Yeah, I really don't. I don't know. I don't know, like, what's happening with the professional teams.
Neither do I. I mean, I think it's awesome that so many of the players are taking initiative and taking action, but I feel like they've been doing that for a long time. I mean,
yeah.
Marta, every single time she wins an award or gets any attention, she never talks about herself. She always tries to use it as a platform for creating change in the women's game. And this has been going on for a very long time. And it's easy to be very dark about it. But again, I'm clinging to the fact that they have just mandated that the pro team, men's teams must have a woman's side. And that's nuts to me. I mean, we haven't done that. I mean, it's not like that in the rest of the world. So the fact that a continent that is constantly known for machismo is the first, I believe they're first to do that, that I'm going to cling to that.
I mean, I guess I can jump in with a question here too. So
yeah, thank you.
Who's speaking? Sorry.
This is Kara Snyder.
Kara, okay, thank you.
Thank you for your question, Alex, and thank you so much, Gwen, for your book and your work and your advocacy and sharing all these stories. I was thinking a lot about. I'm not sure. Have you heard of the organization FIFA Pro?
Yes.
I have not.
International Players Union. Yeah.
Yeah, so I had an interesting conversation with Caitlin Fisher. I don't know if she's mm-hmm. someone who you know. She also played for Santos, so I thought about her a lot as I was reading your book.
Right. We overlapped for about 2 weeks.
So. Oh, wow. Okay. For 2 weeks.
she kind of showed me the ropes, and then I was like, okay, see you later. And then I had no English for the rest of my stay there.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, so she has gotten involved in FIFA Pro and is really thinking about how the categories of women worker and footballer are inseparable. And I thought a lot about workers' rights all throughout your book, like, you know, especially in the Russia chapter, but throughout, like, how is it that, you know, teams can discriminate and, you know, fire players for their sexual orientations, for instance. So I'm just kind of wondering if, and FIFA Pro, so it's this international players union, and 2 years ago they admitted women. And the idea there is that, like, you kind of, like, intersect this loop of how to make women's soccer viable by, like, making sure that they have labor contracts so that they're allowed to practice and play and become, like, thriving players. So I'm just kind of wondering if you have thought about, like, labor rights, or if this book shed a different, like, category of analysis, like, if you're thinking about, like, footballers as workers, if that's something that kind of came to the fore, and then how that, like, sort of supersedes people's national identities. I mean, I think the other thing that comes through is, like, this transnational aspect of, like, bodies moving across borders, and they have more in common with each other through the sport than, like, ties to their national identities, except for that the goal is to play for their national team. So I guess I'm just kind of asking about, like, what is your take on football and workers' rights, and then if you think that's going to do anything interesting with regard to, like, with the nation, the category of the nation.
Yeah, when, I mean, I was, like I said, astounded by the stories of discrimination that I found. I mean, I knew I was writing about adventure, and to me, like, the upside of inequality is that there are astonishing stories out there, and so I wanted to find them. But then when I'm talking to Melissa Barbary, the Australian national team goalkeeper, who's been on the Australian national team since she was 18, and how, you know, she got pregnant, and so then she was just without a team, and she has no rights. There's no maternity policy in the league, and then she's trying to get back and calls every single team in the league trying to here she's played in 3 World Cups. She's Australia's, you know, most accomplished female goalkeeper, and she simply is, you know, there is no system, there is no policy there. That's insane to me. And, you know, England, in the wake of Katie Chapman's experience of Hope Powell just saying, you know, Katie Chapman asks for time off for her family, and then is promptly let go for the next 3 years during her athletic prime. And in the wake of that experience, England has made changes and now does have a maternity policy in place. And I mean, I think it's the naive hope of every author that by exposing the stories and the experiences that change will come. But I don't know whether that's being too naive or not. I mean, to be sure, every single time I'm writing about a situation that is unfair and where a player doesn't have rights and is exposed to things she shouldn't be exposed to, I'm hoping that when people get wind of this, it will help things move forward. But whether that happens or not, I don't know.
I think next in the queue is Martha.
Okay, great. Gwen, this is Martha Saavedra at Berkeley, and I just want to say I really appreciated your book. It's the kind of thing that we've needed for a long time to look at it globally, and players coming from different places. And I love the way that there's obviously a lot of differences across circumstances, but there's convergence in many places, and I think it's comparatively great. It'll be a great teaching tool. I read the whole thing really quickly on the airplane on my iPhone, actually. There's a whole story there, but I used Nook to download it. And then I was really disappointed on my way back. Somehow in the Amsterdam airport, it erased the downloaded book. So when I got on the plane, I didn't have it for the last chapter. So I only got halfway through the last chapter and was too tired last night to finish reading it. But I love the book. And I already have a list of people and organizations that I'm going to say, you've got to read this book and look at different chapters. Right now, there's a group of people who want to bring pro soccer to Oakland. You know, we have the men's earthquake team in down in San Jose, but they're trying to bring pro soccer to Oakland. So I want to make sure they have this. They've talked, yeah, there has to be a women's side to it also. But anyway, they're all about social impact. So I'm hoping that folks like that will look at this and get a better sense of what's going on. So kudos to you. The question.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, the question that I have is about the process of pulling this together. And, it's kind of a series of questions, like, how did you pick the stories? How did you find the people to interview? And I'm betting that you have many, many more stories and other people that you came across, maybe even that you talked to, that you couldn't get into the book. So I'm wondering about the process and if there's more material that might come out someplace else.
Yeah, sure. So I basically, having played myself, it's the network of players makes the world small. So, my roommate in college was Thora Helgadottir, who's the Icelandic national team keeper, and he played Rosengarten in Sweden. And so, she knows players who know players, and a couple of my Duke teammates are currently playing in NWSL. So it was a process of just getting people to connect me. And then I was the kind of team journalist for the U.S. national team ahead of the World Cup, where I helped kind of find the stories for the videos they created for 23 players, one team. And while I was talking to those players, I would hear tidbits of things. So I had heard, for example, that Russia was the craziest story of all, and I actually heard a rumor that players would have to carry bags and they wouldn't know what was in those bags, and that was the story I heard. I was never able to confirm that story, and never heard that again while talking to players. But I started talking to Averbusch and then heard about other players and just kind of talked to as many players as I could. And that's kind of how it went for every story, where I would hear something and then see if I could find a way to talk to that player. Then there was also like the Nigerian national team, any African team. I didn't know anything about any of them. So it was really important to me that I find a way to get to actually hear an experience from a player on a team in Africa. And so that process went something like going onto the Nigerian national team's Wikipedia page and looking at what clubs they play for. And then I saw that one player played for US college. So then I called the college coach and asked if they'd be willing to connect me with the Nigerian player, and the Nigerian player then was able to connect me with her teammates, and so that was kind of the process there. As for stories, I was pregnant and then had a newborn while I was writing this under deadline, so I actually, like, every story I wrote is in here, and that there were things I'd catch, like whiffs of other stories, but just didn't have time to go investigate more. So interestingly enough, though, since the book has come out, people have been reaching out to me and emailing me other fascinating stories. Like, this is by no means like all the best stories in women's soccer. I think that it's, the tip of the iceberg. And I think that the more these stories do get put out there, the more we'll hear about. So For example, yesterday someone emailed me about there's a player on the Spanish national team who's deaf, and I had never heard about her at all before, and I'm really hopeful of writing that story in the future. So I definitely think there are a lot more stories out there. So I'm excited to keep doing this.
So if you write more stories, they would come out in, say, a magazine form or something like that, you think, or a second book?
I would imagine a magazine form. I mean, it's tricky. Now that I have kids, it's just so hard financially, where every single time I write a story, it's losing money, like losing significant amounts of money, because it costs me $15 an hour, and I'm a slow writer. I mean, I'm very, very slow. So it's, and obviously, as I'm sure most of you guys know, I mean, writing articles, it's tricky, but it made me identify with the players a lot. Like every time, the players are making nothing and I'm making nothing while writing about the players, and we have that in common. So I hope that I will find a way and time to write about these very worthwhile stories for magazines in the near future.
Great, thank you.
Excellent. Well, focusing on the book, when, it's amazing. Portland Thorns won the NWSL title just as the book came out. So they should give you something for that, right? You produced a lot of good karma for them after they had failed in previous years. And you've got that wonderful cover with all the Thorns players coming together and embracing, which is what happened at the end of that final. And you do a marvelous job in the book about, highlighting and profiling some of their key players, Ali Long and Nadia Nadim and so many others. In my household, the star that gets the most love is Tobin Heath. But that must be the Italian in us with the fancy footwork. And you've got that great ending with the riveters and bringing out this wonderful color. But you're also pointing out to me that Portland is a really exceptional case. It's a wonderful success story, 17,000 a game, etc. So how representative do you think Portland is of broader trends and reality? And, what is the conundrum for women's soccer in the United States that Portland might be held up as a great model when so much of the factors that have gone into making this phenomenon are almost impossible to reproduce elsewhere?
I don't know if I think that's true. This is the big question, and I just came back from a book tour in Portland, that was the question, and I still don't know the answer. I don't think anyone does, but like obviously, yes, Portland has incredible advantages. They are in the center of the city. There's a huge soccer mad population. They can use all of the infrastructure from the Timbers. All of that is true, but I don't think that's unrecreatable. I mean, there are other NWSL teams that are paired with men's teams and that have desirable stadiums. To be sure, there are also teams that don't have desirable locations and don't have the support of a men's team. But to me, like after my experience in Portland, I mean, the thing that made it go wild is one, it's not out of obligation. I'm sure that most of you have seen the Pass the Ball commercial. I love Ellen DeGeneres, and I love the intent behind the video, but it was very much we should support our women. And I don't think that's the way to make a professional league successful. I mean, it's got to be, you want to do it, and it's fun. I mean, it's hip to go to a Thorns game. You go because like, it's a wild experience. And what's making it that wild experience are the fans. I mean, it's the incredible amount of work and time and thought and investment that the fans put into the women's game. So to me, it's how you get those rabid fans in other places. And each team does have a supporters group. And yes, there are more Riveters than there are members of, say, Cloud9, but when I also talk to the members of Cloud9, you know, they're equally passionate and are trying to use their more meager resources and their undesirable stadium location, but they're investing so much energy and thought, and that, like, I don't think there is some sort of secret answer. It's just, it takes so much work and time. I mean, when I was there, I was helping create the TIFO display ahead of the last season home game, and I was there helping in a garage for 5 hours, maybe, and the people I was working with had been there for 10 hours before I got there. I mean, they were doing all-nighters because they were so excited by the idea of creating this display. And that was just that day, you know, they'd been that there's so much time and thought put into everything. And so it becomes an experience. Everyone wants to see what the TIFO is going to be. The chants are so creative. I mean, it's just everybody nerds out on everything. And that I do think is recreatable. It's finding, you know, a core of people who can start spreading this fever and this interest. I also think that we need stadiums in the center of cities. I think that we have to stop appealing to mothers and kids. Speaking as a mother of a four-year-old and a one-year-old, mothers are busy. Families are busy. You cannot build the amount of season ticket holders based on families. I mean, we will come when we can, but you need 25-year-old males there too. And so beer is important. I mean, I'm kind of cribbing this from Joanna Lohman's article, but if you haven't seen that, she wrote a piece on how to make the NWSL and women's professional soccer work. And it's brilliant. I mean, it's spot on. It's, you know, it has to be fun. It has to be a little rowdy. We can't keep thinking that club soccer players and families are the way to make the NWSL succeed. I also think that you know, when I was a kid, I watched the 99 World Cup, and I remember being the commercials there. I don't, maybe you guys are, will remember the same commercials I do, but there was the "I will have two fillings" campaign. Do you guys remember that? Somebody has to have two fillings. I think it's Brandi Chastain. But so then Mia Hamm stands up and says, "Well, then I will have two fillings." And then the whole waiting room, they all stand up, and because one's getting two fillings, so will the rest. And then there was the other commercial where somebody in cribs are, I think the kick in the crib is already astonishing. I mean, they were so cool and funny and hip. And that, you know, that level of creative marketing and support from the heavyweights has not been as present for the women's pro league. And I teach a college in California, and to this day I have never had a student who even knows the women's pro league existed. I mean, granted, I teach at an art school, but I mean, I also teach at a community college, and those students don't know it either, and I have soccer lovers in there too. And I just, you know, when you don't enter the national conversation, yeah, you're not going to get fans. So I think a lot of it is you need Nike to make commercials. You need the biggies to do it. And I think Lifetime is making a tremendous effort. And I love the player profiles that they've been doing. And I think that they've done great game coverage. And that is a big step in the right direction. But I've heard that ratings have a long way to go. And I don't know. I don't know what you do to change that.
Thank you. Question from David and then Sean.
Hi, honor to speak with you again, Gwendolyn, and congratulations on the book. It's another triumph. I'm very interested, first of all, in modes of writing. Having seen Pilata before I read Finding the Game, I've always been struck by those kinds of different modes of representation that you straddle between the two and the relationship between them. So reading Under the Lights and In the Dark, I really am hoping for a film version of that. I understand you're busy with the 4-year-old and the 1-year-old, but I'm actually driving to pick up my 13-year-old and 17-year-old, so I have to tell you, it does get better. It actually does get better. But more than anything, I think my big takeaway from this book, like your descriptions of the underground soccer scene in Queens, the futsal courts, and the issues of gender that come up with that, to me, that there's this really fascinating theme that goes back to Finding the Game in Pilata, the idea of following your bliss, and, you know, this kind of boulevard of broken dreams and these great players that come together in these obscure sites, these pitches that are in the margins. And given the fact that you're a parent now of 2 children who are just about to enter the ages where they start getting into the system, whether it's the local AYSO or whatever it may be, I just wonder how you may be thinking about this or how your parenting may start influencing the way in which you're looking at that. You know, what options you may be considering for your own children. What do you see wrong with the program, the national program? Obviously, the crisis we're in on the men's side, maybe we're not looking as much as the potential crisis on the women's side, but adopting the Development Academy model and stuff, is that a step in the right direction or a step in the wrong direction? I guess I'm just wondering if, as you've looked at more and more of these stories and you continue pursuing these stories, how your story may play out in the stories that you're going to see evolve with your own children.
Yeah. Okay. So let me try it. That's a lot of really interesting stuff. So, okay, let's see. Definitely what I learned from Pilata, which took me, 25 countries in 3 years to sort of realize is, I was so accomplishment based. It was important to me to get recognition. And when you play on the fields in the middle of nowhere with people, like, this is their happiness. I mean, all over the world, whether we were playing with businessmen in Tokyo on the top of skyscrapers or moonshine brewers in Kenya, like, this is happiness. And like, no matter where you are or whether anyone is watching or whether anyone cares, it feels good to try hard and play well. And that's the case for the stories that I just wrote about. And Under the Lights, to me, ultimately, it's a story of women doing something they find beautiful no matter what. I mean, even though there is no money and there is no fame and they will have to encounter unbelievable obstacles and low moments, it's worth it to them to continue to play the game they love. As a parent, that is definitely how I will be going at it. I mean, sure, would I like them to be able to get a college scholarship because of soccer? Yes. But more importantly, I want them to just know what it's like to love something and to be able to feel graceful at something and to know that I want them, my ultimate goal, and, I've got a friend who I run with, and her kids are a bit older than mine, so I'm a little bit in the dark about the whole Development Academy stuff, except via my friend Jen, who, as we run, she tells me about her 3 boys and who made which Development Academy team and who's on the reserve team. And, my son also loves to surf and he's doing so well in surfing. And now how will he devote enough time to be really good at soccer? And, if you're on the Academy team, you don't have to pay for it. And I know about academies via her. It's that pressure that's always been there of, can you play other sports? And are we getting, is this academy thing, does that kill the magic of organic pickup games and just meeting with your friends on the field? And I mean, in pretty much every single country we went to, we heard that same thing of people saying, oh, pickup is dying, and oh, it's all this academy stuff now. And I don't know if you can really say how it's influenced. I mean, academies produced Messi, but also, I mean, even as that pickup is dying thing comes out, there's then the backlash against that of so many communities who cherish this more informal games and the just playing because you love it. I mean, to me, just I'm incredibly competitive. I don't want to play a pickup game that's just for fun. I want to play a pickup game where I will get yelled at. And, you know, we play in that. There's a Persian pickup game on Tuesday nights where I get yelled at if I do poorly. And I love that. And so to me, soccer is a vehicle for teaching, you know, discipline, dedication, and just how good it feels to try. So my 4-year-old, no, he doesn't love it. So I won't give up on him yet, but there are so many things the game has to offer, and I'm hoping that we'll get further into the questions of how it's being carried out in the U.S. As I encounter it more. So I'm not sure if I answered your question. Feel free to fire follow-up questions to any part I didn't address.
Well, I have to say as a follow-up, I hope you'll volunteer to coach your kids.
We do. I do coach. I volunteer with the 4 and 5-year-olds on Sundays with Annie, who's a 75 maybe, a player who used to play in Scotland, and she is the one who gets the kids together, and I help out, and that's very fun. So I do that. Oh, also, your question about video versus writing, I will say that there's been lots of interest in the video form of the Ali Long story, and so there's definitely some stuff on the horizon there. And there are many stories where my documentary itch comes back in some form. That's definitely a possibility for Under the Lights.
Terrific. That would be great. Thanks.
That sure. Sounds very exciting. Well, it's just about halftime of the session. So, Sean, next question to you.
Okay, thank you. Well, Gwen, just want to reiterate what everybody's been saying. I'm giving you accolades. Fantastic book. And I actually have only seen Perlada. I hadn't read it, and I just was really struck by the quality of writing in this book.
Thank you.
Particularly just the flow of the narrative is fantastic. I work in fiction a lot, and so reading nonfiction that has just such great detail and character development too is such a pleasure. I think it was Alex that was sort of talking about being struck immediately by Ali Long, the beginning, and the slap to the face in the Russia chapter. And that was something that I was really paying attention to throughout, was sort of the intensity and also subtleties of sort of the male hostility that exists to women's and girls' participation in football. And it's something that is not easy to articulate. I think, like, I use the documentary Mujeres con Pelotas when I'm teaching cultures of football in Latin America. And I just think I'm excited to be able to incorporate some of your book into this course.
Awesome.
Particularly the chapter on Marta is fantastic. She is someone who I've always been just so perplexed how little the football world uses her to build the sport, right? And particularly in Brazil. I was just in Brazil this summer, and I was going to actually update the question about where we are at. I think it was Alex also who had asked the question about development in Brazil, and I can say that, I mean, it's at a place that I've never seen it before. I would say it's a positive thing. I actually saw some games being televised on cable sport channels. Sport TV had some of the games televised. And I know that there were reported 15,000 fans at one of the legs of the final between Santos and Corinthians.
Nice.
Santos did win the league this year, there's Serie A and B that is happening, and so there's some interesting movement. But of course, you know, when we look at what's going on with Emily Lima, it's like as always, sort of two steps forward, one step back, right. Or maybe even one step forward, two steps back. My question for you was just, it's sort of kind of along the lines of David's, I was sort of
Uh-oh.
Wanting to
Hello?
Get, can you hear me?
Hello? Can you guys
Hello?
Hear me?
Yep.
Oh, can okay. everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So my question is just, I love the title. I think particularly the dark portion, because there is so much darkness in the world of women's football. I mean, the Russia chapter is the levels of harassment, but also even assault. And I was wondering if there are any particular anecdotes that were not told in this book. Are there any additional untold tales that you can share with us?
I will say that in the Russia chapter, I heard a lot of more stories than I could end up including in the book, because I just couldn't get a firsthand source. So stuff, there's worse stuff that I heard about happening, but just journalistically, without being able to hear it firsthand from the players, I couldn't include those moments in the book. But I mean, I think you can sort of figure out what genre of experience that would be in. So But yeah, there was a lot more in Russia that just I couldn't quite fact check enough to include. And I don't really think it would be honorable to like pass on what is ultimately hearsay, but there was a lot of hearsay. Or as far as other anecdotes that didn't make it in the book, I really tried to include I was writing madly up to get everything in. I know that Colombia, I got wind of some pretty crazy stories with the Colombian women's national team, but I think Natalie Arias is going to attempt to tell those stories herself, so I'm very excited to hear when she does decide to share some of those experiences, because it sounds like I think that there is a whole lot of things that go on in the women's game. And, you know, as a player myself and having gone around the world, and I was included in every game, like I was never rejected. I was never, yes, in the beginning of each game, men would like play daintily against me. And then it quickly changed, and I felt very accepted around the world and never discriminated against. And my experience in Brazil, I knew that I would encounter lots of inequality, but I had no sense of what was out there ultimately.
All right, thank you. I just a quick follow-up, if I can. I just also, sure. I was wondering if you have had any official reception from FIFA, either directly or indirectly.
I will, maybe every author is a little bit disappointed once their book comes out by the lack of like sort of attention. No, definitely not. Although I did just send a copy of the book to Moya Dodd. I don't know. I sent a copy there, but no. It's really hard to get people to know your book exists, and it's really hard to get anyone to pay attention. I mean, I sent a whole lot of copies out to a lot of places, but it's been pretty quiet. So that's been a little disappointing.
Yeah, I think many of us can relate to that disappointment on various levels.
I probably.
Martha.
Okay, actually, your last answer kind of got to one of the questions that I had. I think we have to start tweeting at Moya and Mary and some other people, and maybe they'll pick up on it, because Moya really does seem to care. So I did have a question about how it was being received, but I guess you answered that. But my other question, though, there was one part when you're talking about the English national team and the women who were pregnant, and it seemed like Mark Sampson was a little bit of the hero there, that he was like, great, we're gonna let people play. But now he's sort of fallen in disgrace.
Right.
And the issues, I don't know if everybody knows the Mark Sampson story, why he was dismissed. There was an old case from way back. Well, there was also the racism case that was just been in Parliament and everything. But also he had apparently done something in his and the another club a while ago, and there was a report on that, and the FA hadn't looked at that, and basically he had inappropriate relationships with players, and whether or not that happened when he was captain of the women's national team in England or anything is that I didn't hear that specifically. But I'm curious, when you write something like this, and I think, it looks like you were writing up almost to the point that it was published. So a lot of the stories were really, really current, but then things happen,
right.
Like with Mark Sampson. So I'm curious, maybe about that story specifically, if you had heard other things, or, if you had talked to Mark Sampson, or maybe not, but also in general, the issues of, it wasn't really sexual harassment he was charged with, but right now that's also a big issue with the whole Hollywood story and Donald Trump and everything. But I'm curious about the coach-player relations and when I was in Senegal, one of the big issues that was murmured all the time was this, some of the coaches who were really promoting women's soccer were also accused of sexually harassing women too, but that never got out in the open, and the man's now dead, and I don't know that the situation would ever be able to do that, but parents were always very concerned if their kids went to go play, their daughters went to play, that was the big concern that they had, that they would be somehow harassed by the men involved in the game. So I'm curious about that that dynamic, and that if that came up, or if you have other insights into that.
Can you guys? Okay, I think I lost you for a little bit, but I heard the gist of it. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Bend It Like Beckham, obviously when it came out, I was so excited. I think there's so much great stuff in that film, but I was appalled by the coach-player dynamic, like players fighting over who gets to like romance the coach. I hated that representation of female athletes. That being said, in my experience, I'm trying to say this without players sleeping with coaches was not was not very, that happened, that definitely happened. I had incredible coaches myself who were wonderful and careful, and I think coaches got a lot more careful of making sure situations didn't make players feel uncomfortable as years have gone on, where before, you know, in athletics there's so much intimacy, there's so many power dynamics, there's so much banter and teasing, and that can easily get out of hand, especially for you know, players who are often marginalized. And in writing the book, issues of sexual harassment as well as racist interactions, that wasn't something I really encountered, minus the Play Away the Gay chapter, where I don't know if I would use the term sexual harassment, but to be sure, where sexuality confronted evangelical Christianity, just there were very tension-filled moments. So I am relieved to say that while I was hunting and prowling for stories, that was not what I encountered. I did not hear about the Mark Sampson thing, but I will also say that, like, that's what I would say. And players were very open to with me, I think, because I never had a desire to write in a way that, I don't know, I heard David Sedaris say something about when someone asked him writing about his family members, like, are they okay with that? And he's like, well, yeah, because even when I'm ripping on them and making fun of them, like, they always know I'm writing from a place of love. And I mean, and maybe that sounds cheesy, but to be sure, when I'm covering the women's game, I am writing from a place of love and you know, trying to honor these players who I think are, you know, really, really inspiring and how they're changing the game for the future. Maybe that's a bit of a tangent at the end.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have a new person on the call, Kevin. I don't know if you like asking a question now, Kevin, or if you want to just hold on.
Hi, everybody. I'm sorry for being late. I'm based in Europe, so it's nighttime here, and my son just got to bed. So I apologize for joining you guys a little bit on the late side. I'll slowly get into this. I'm just kind of connecting. So if there's someone else who has a question, please feel free, and I will jump in a little bit then.
Okay, thank you, Kevin, and welcome. Let's see, Daniel from Beirut.
Yeah, I also have the kid issue, and one is sleeping, one is not yet sleeping. I have a question. So, Gwen, where do you see, like, the big future issues for women football? Now, we just had this historic pay deal in Norway that a federation announced that they would pay a woman equally to men. Is this, from your point of view, what you see as the big issue, that all over the world women should try to get the same pay? Or what should be, like, the main priority, the main issue in the near future?
You know, so I feel like this is a question that many of you can probably answer better than I can, in that I'm, you know, I've entrenched myself in the stories, and hoping that sharing these stories will then inspire people like you guys, who seem very awesome at thinking, like, systematically and how we can forward the game. And I will say that, yes, obviously, like, equal pay is hugely important, but maybe more than equal pay, I'm and they're obviously closely related, equal opportunity, exposure. I posted ahead of the NWSL final on my Facebook page, like, who here's watching the game? And like, nobody responded because nobody where I am watched the final. And people don't know about it. We're not in the national conversation. And that's true for a whole lot of places. But I do think we're in a really important moment in time where that's changing. I can't speak intelligently about the situation in Spain, but I've heard just bits that I keep meaning to go dig into further that, you know, Barcelona, they're getting thousands of people, like huge turnouts to women's games. And you know, for every negative, terrible thing you hear about, oh my God, what? Vera Boquet wasn't selected for the Spanish national team, like that, you know, that wasn't based on ability. But then you hear about something positive. And I think that just getting the game exposure, which will then create interest from the public, will then make it a feasible financial model. So I think equal pay is important, but I don't think it should be like a charity thing. I think the reason why women don't get equal pay is because there's not equal exposure and equal opportunity in making it a viable business model is, I think, really important. And the way to do that is, I mean, it's an egg, chicken before the egg thing, and just getting backing from the heavyweights and getting media to talk about it. I mean, the women's national team just played in New Orleans, and the people I follow on Twitter was saying, like, he's been in New Orleans all week. He didn't see a single advertisement for the game. 10,000 people came, which is not what it could be. And just how I think the media has got to really get involved. And I think there have been huge steps forward all in every country. I mean, I know France just did a movement where I'm forgetting the term, but they were really trying to focus more on women's sports. And there are so many issues. It's hard to pick just one, but I'd definitely be interested in hearing thoughts from you guys on what the key to moving forward is.
Perhaps this is something we can return to just a little bit later, because it's so critical to everything we're talking about today. Is that all right with the group?
Of course.
Sure.
Because I do have a question now in the queue from Patrick. So why don't we take Patrick's question, maybe another one or two, and then return to these very important issues.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Well, this kind of ties in with what Gwen was just saying, especially with the media representations. And you mentioned, I was thinking about the representation of women in soccer, and you were talking about Bennett like Beckham, the romance with, you know, the coach. I do a lot of studies with discourse analysis in Brazil, you know, the framing of Marta as Pelé com falda, or Pelé with the skirt. And then I see stories like the objectification of women in the story La Gringa, the Ali Long piece. So I just wanted to hear your experience with, you know, this type of discourse, you know, framing women in relation to men, kind of perpetuating typical gender roles and construction, and commenting on how your book kind of serves as a way to deconstruct those, I guess, hegemonic or dominant discourses.
My internet connection seemed to have failed for a chunk of your question, so let me make sure that I'm getting the gist of your question. The way women are often framed in terms of men, is that essentially your question?
Right, yes. The traditional representations, when they're framed with men. I was commenting on Bennett like Beckham, or Marta being framed in comparison with Pelé, or and I was talking about La Gringa, the Ali Long piece that you wrote.
She's okay. Right. So, when Marta, you know, Pele, after he saw Marta play, and I wrote about this in the Brazil chapter, he said, it is like watching Pele with skirts, or I get maybe someone else said that, and then he was like, I agree, she is like Pele, she's like Pele with skirts, except her legs are much nicer than mine. And there was definitely an appalled reaction to, you know, the focus on her legs, and but Marta herself, you know, said, wasn't offended, and the fact that here was this huge legend in her country who for the first time was like bringing the women's game to the attention of the country. This was like in 2007. You know, she was flattered, she said. And to be sure, I think that the women's game and the men's game are different. And it is maddening to me that there's constantly comparisons, and I just, you know, women's tennis and men's tennis are different sports, and they're both beautiful to watch. Lilian Theron says something that to me, like, it's much more eloquent than how I could put it, but I think that, you know, he said that when it comes down to it, sports, we watch sports for emotion, but whether you're watching women or men, like, it's the emotion that's why we're watching. And it's present for both the men and the women. And as far as like being framed in terms of men, I don't know, as a player, when I'm compared to, you know, if someone tried to compare me to Luka Modric, I would be over the moon. And I don't think comparing women players to men players is necessarily problematic. I mean, I would also be over the moon if someone compared me to Marta or Mia Hamm. To be clear, no one would ever do that. I would never, my game would never be compared to any of these greats. But we grew up watching men, I think women's players, we love beautiful soccer, whether it's men or female playing. And I think that what women's players want is the same courtesy, where to be appreciated for great soccer, and just gender to step aside for a bit. As far as, you know, I taught a gender in sports class, or I was a TA for at Duke, and then I did a unit during my composition classes back in the day. And one thing that there's a Helen Shugart, an academic gender in sports writer, pointed out, I guess was years ago, but it's still true, just how women are often, like, you know, and I'm sure I'm not saying anything new to any of you guys, but are often portrayed in terms of, you know, it's always a male coach or a male figure, a brother who taught them everything they know, and that's like to make them less threatening, or, you know, they're portrayed in terms of their boyfriends or husbands or children in order to emphasize that they are heterosexual and therefore sexually viable, and therefore don't worry, like, sports won't turn them into angry lesbians. And that seems to be still the case in much media coverage, where you are emphasizing femininity, or and trying to make clear that they're heterosexual. But I also think that's changing a lot. And I think that there's no longer the rush to emphasize heterosexuality as much, at least in our country. I can't speak for the world, but and I think a lot of that is thanks to the players. I think it's players like Megan Rapinoe and Abby Wambach, who are, coming out. And I think that one thing I will say that, you know, isn't necessarily in the book, this was a question earlier, I did talk to players who were sort of in awe of Pino and so grateful to her and envious, because they were in situations where they could never come out and could, in their country, could never live their life openly. And so Rapinoe and the other players who are coming out, it's it's having major impressions on players around the rest of the world who don't feel that they can come out. So again, I'm not entirely sure I've answered your question, partially because I didn't hear half of it. So sorry.
No, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Again, congratulations on the book. I look forward to incorporating it in my literature classes, because I really think it helps to bring those voices and these stories to the forefront and to highlight women as these athletes and their athleticism. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
While we wait for the next question to appear in the virtual queue, I have another question for you, Gwen. It has to do with how people write about soccer, football. In men's writing about men's football, it seems that the game is often a kind of lens through which to understand generational relations and identities. Your book seems to focus a lot on kind of women between the age of, and here I'm being very crude, 18 and 40. You know, it's very focused on the players in particular, although there are, of course, moments in which the teens appear quite memorably in that last section on the riveters with the 13-year-old former, you know, teen beauty pageant winner, and
now is going to play the lead in Broadway.
Well, there you go, awesome. and you've got some older women in there too. But do you think that the women's game kind of has that same quality, can provide that same lens to understand the sort of generational relations between women in the way that men have been writing about men's football?
Interesting. This makes me think of pickup soccer. In so many countries, you know, the game is passed down from generation to generation. And in the United States, that especially in the women's game, that's not as much true, where, you know, we're still sort of in very early stages of the women's game. And for most of my generation, you know, I'm 33, and none of our families played. We did not have parents who played the game. It was parents who fell in love with the game through us, which is a different dynamic than men's players around the world. That being said, you know, there's such a dearth of stories on the women's game, and that's true for the present, let alone the past. So after my book has come out, I like I mentioned earlier, I've been hearing so many more stories, and I would love the chance. I was focused on the current generation, but I'm also really interested in the players that came before 1999. Michelle Akers wasn't the first. I mean, there was a whole generation of women that we know nothing about, and that's true for so many countries. And I know England has a really rich history of women's soccer and, you know, women's teams in wartime. And these stories were not focused on generational links, because for most of these players, you know, there was nothing. But that's not to say that there was nothing in their family histories, but there are the earlier generation of women's players, I feel like are kind of largely ignored, and that there isn't a huge connection between pre-99 players and the current. I think Julie Foudy and Mia Hamm and the 99ers have done an amazing job of trying to push the game in every way they possibly can and staying in it. And I do think that there hasn't been much work on generational successors, and I am very interested in that, although you're right that is not the focus of Under the Lights.
Great, thank you. We have two questions in the queue. Kevin, aka Julie, and then David.
thanks, Peter. There's so much to talk about here. This is so fascinating, and I wish we had more time. I'll add my congratulations, Gwen. Thanks so much for contributing this with another book and more, you know, more fuel for all of this. I wanted to come back to maybe some of the economic aspects, just to maybe encourage you to share any other things that maybe aren't so much in the book. But I was curious, from an economic point of view, I mean, you mentioned that things need to focus on, you know, creating a viable business model for women's football. And, you know, the Portland Thorns case study is an interesting one. And there's obviously a huge push in governing bodies, I think, in national associations around the world. You know, they're being pushed by, a whole policy which is focused on developing women's football. Some of that is focused on directed spending in women's programs, et cetera, which is great. It will hopefully help stimulate the women's game in places where, you know, women don't have the same opportunities to play. And then, that's fantastic. But to come back to what you were saying about the viable business model, I just think it's interesting to see that, you know, the whole question of equal pay, the Norwegian case recently, and even another one, which I don't know if anyone mentioned earlier, but it's, which is the recent Danish women's national team strike, which isn't fully resolved as far as I understand, but they have at least agreed to find some sort of middle ground in order to play their World Cup qualifier. I mean, can anyone imagine a side outside of the US, perhaps 10 years ago, 15 years ago, another women's football national team going on strike? That's just phenomenal. It's incredible. I'll get to my question. Gwen, what in all of the research that you did, you know, the storytelling and the background stories and all of that, what were the biggest obstacles and opportunities that you saw from an economic perspective to the game in terms of a viable business model?
I went to play in Brazil for free. I didn't get paid, and that was true for all of my teammates except for a handful. That was what, 10 years ago, a little bit more than 10 years ago. Wow, I'm old. I think 10 years ago, that was sort of the situation where women were just grateful to play. Like, we love the game and just wanted a chance to play. And I'd like to think that we've progressed. We're now like, yes, we would like to play, but we would also like to be able to make a good living while doing it, and to be recognized. I mean, these women are so talented and have done so much, and so to constant. I think when you give someone an equal salary, you give them more credibility. You're treating them like it's just a huge game changer. And so then maybe with equal pay comes equal attention. Attention. I think that's the big obstacle is no one pays attention. And I mean, I think all of us, everyone in the women's game is asking how you change that. And you know, when you've got, how long has SportsCenter been going on? I mean, does anyone know? I don't know.
Probably what, 30 something years. Yeah?
Yeah, something like that.
So it shows like that, you know, that create the conversation. And when women haven't been in those shows and in those weekly highlights for 28 of those years, then it's hard to change the culture where women's sports are as legitimate of a thing as men's sports. And then once we do that, then there will be more pay opportunities everywhere. There'll Sorry, so my son just got home from preschool, so there may be a four-year-old barking in.
There may be a pitch invasion.
but he is heading up the stairs. So, I am talking about obstacles in salaries. I mean, it's hard to even talk about obstacles in salaries because there just aren't salaries for so many of the women playing professionally. I mean, one thing, you know, in the Nigeria chapter, I was really inspired by the Nigerian Women's Pro League in that, you know, it started, they have a national sports day and women were included, I think, I want to say 1990 maybe, women soccer was included for the first time then, and there was a huge public interest, and so the president's wife, as well as these influential female business leaders in the Nigerian community, they all pitched in and found a way to get the Women's Professional League started. And the Nigerian Women's Pro League is one of the oldest women's pro leagues going in the world. And they have big issues, but they also have been offering women a chance to make a living, which is more playing the game they love, which is more than most countries can say. For decades now. And the one thing they did talk about salary obstacle-wise was they would go months without seeing their salary, and they'd be promised salaries and then never get them. And I know that they spoke to me about hearing how they had no idea that you got money if you like made it to a World Cup, or that there were incentives and rewards like that. I had never seen the results of that. So Russia, I mean, in Russia, these players were promised huge salaries. That's why they went there. And some players did receive salaries in some years that were much better salaries than the other countries were offering. Other years, no one got paid at all. And, you know, it's one thing when you're an American not to get paid the salary you were promised. It's another thing when you're a Cameroonian and your entire family is counting on you and you're the breadwinner, and then you've got nothing to send home to your family. There's a lot.
Yeah, very good points. Love the reference to the Nigerian League when so I tweeted the journal article that Martha wrote a few years back that has a very nice discussion of the Nigerian Pro League going back to the 80s. With by the way, women entrepreneurs really playing a central role in that. Sorry, I took my eye off the chat function. So let's see. Martha said the Nigerian women's team had a sit-in in December 2016 after winning the Africa Cup of Nations for the umpteenth time, protesting the lack of pay. Yeah. So yeah, and also the Australian team, it was noted, went on strike as well. Let's see. Kevin notes something about, oh yeah, the increasing divide between wealthy women's clubs, like, you know, there are a few, not many, but a few, like PSG in France, which has done wonderful things, Kevin says, to develop the economic opportunities for women, but have also distorted the professional women's game in France, right? Interestingly, as women's soccer at the professional level develops further, are we going to see that same gaping inequality between the elite clubs and the overwhelming majority of everyone else? Right? Are we going to get sort of the Manchester United, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern types on, you know, in their own little NFL-style world, and then everybody else playing in essentially a kind of minor league setup? Right. That's something to consider as well, obviously with differences in scale. Any thoughts on that? And maybe we can start bringing the conversation to a close, unless David wants to. Were you in the queue also, David?
No? Okay. Anyone else?
No, yeah, I was just...
Oh, David, yes. I thought you were in the queue. Apologies.
Yeah, sorry. I promise I'll try to be brief. Gwen, just another question about genre, since you've worked on documentary film, and now this is your second book, but since you've done so much work in nonfiction, obviously you find so much power in these stories that you've discovered, but have you considered any fictional projects, either for film or the book?
Yeah, so I was in the middle of writing fiction when I got this book offer to go write this, and I was kind of torn up about it because to be totally honest, I was really excited to write a book that didn't have the word soccer in it. I'm in love with stories and books, and like discovered sort of the soccer niche, and just the fact that no one was writing about these very worthwhile stories. And so initially I was disappointed to have to put down my fiction book and to write more soccer. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to do that until I started talking to the players and was blown away by their incredibly inspiring stories. Now, obviously, like I feel like so lucky to have been able to take part in sharing their stories. But my fictional book, I am so itching. I've never had so much fun writing something. Not to say I don't have fun when writing soccer, but I read mainly fiction, and I'm obsessed with fiction. So thank you for asking. Yes, I do have the book in the drawer that might take me 10 years to write, but I do hope to one day finish that. and also in relation to the leagues thing, like, yes, I think there's major disparity between teams, and, you know, you are going to see blowouts and teams with huge budgets and teams with no budgets. And that's a current thing. And I think that when you have one team with huge budgets, I gotta hope that will have effect on the league as a whole, and that other teams would be increasing their budgets, and that, you know, I'm very optimistic when it comes to these things. So I think that it is not a bad problem to have a team with too much money. I will say that when I was in Portland with the Riveters, and they were, you know, bemoaning the loss of some of their international players to teams with much bigger budgets, they sort of said, well, they'll make a big salary, but, you know, that they're going to lose the experience of playing in front of 17 rabid fans. And I would hope that to me, more than the disparity between the gap in budgets for teams, it's depressing to play for a team with that much money and have no fans in the stadium. Like, how, if you've got the big budget, but only have 1,000 fans, that's the depressing part for me. And I'd hope that, and maybe someone knows more of that. How many fans does PSG get, and how many fans does Man City get per week? I'm not sure of that. And I would hope that those numbers are constantly growing because of the investment from the top.
Any final points? We're in stoppage time. Anyone out there?
Well, thank you guys so much for everyone tuning in, and I really appreciated getting to talk with you guys, and please don't hesitate to reach out if there's any other things I can answer, or any way I can, I'm happy to talk to anyone.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Gwen. It was a real pleasure to read the book and to discuss it with you and everyone else. And I'll be assigning the book in my classes for sure. And maybe we can bug you for a few moments of your time at that point as well.
Of course.
And we will make the audio available with a short wrap-up on the website, the FSF website. So look for an email in the coming days about that. And in early December, we're going to have a session with Anthony Clavain on his book about growing up in Leeds with Leeds United, and That would be in early December, so look for an email about that as well, all right?
Awesome, thank you guys.
Okay, take care everyone.
Thank you, Gwen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye guys, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, good night from Beirut.